So I think most of us have heard of the story of David and Goliath. The story goes like this. The nation of Israel, the Israelites, were at war with this neighboring nation called the Philistines. And so Philistines sent out a giant, Goliath, to fight, essentially 1v1, calling, if you want to come challenge us, 1v1 us. And everybody in Israel was scared, and rightfully so, including the king of Israel, King Saul. Now, in the midst and in the camp, there was this youth, there was this teenager, there was this musician called David. David, he was a musician for King Saul, and he was an armor bearer for King Saul, and he went and he gone ahead and defeated Goliath with a slingshot. And so after that, the Israelites defeated the Philistines in battle. That was the story of David and Goliath, and I think most of us have heard of that story. Now, I don't know how many of you heard the rest of the story that happens after that, the story of David and Saul. It happens that as they were returning from battle, the people, as you may expect, they were celebrating and they were having a parade. And so they were coming home, and the woman came out of all the cities of Israel, and they're singing and they were dancing to meet King Saul. And they had tambourines and they were singing songs and they had musical instruments. And the woman sang to one another as they celebrated. They sang, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. Everybody was having a great time. Everybody was happy other than one person, King Saul. Saul was very angry because the saying, the song, that lyric line displeased him. He said, they have given to David 10,000s and they have given me thousands. He was the first king of Israel, and now people rank him second. He won hundreds and hundreds of battles before, and now this is only one battle, and he's losing to a shepherd boy. And so he thought, what more can he have now but the kingdom? If David is placed above me today, one day he's going to take my spot. And so Saul eyed David from that day on, as in he started to pay attention to him. He started to guard against him. And some translations have it, he starts to get jealous of him. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and Saul raved within his house whilst David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. And Saul had his spear in his hand, and he hurled the spear because he thought, I'm going to pin this little boy to the wall. But David evaded him twice. Saul's envy and jealousy is now taking over him and making him go crazy. So Saul removed David from his presence and made David a commander of 1,000. And David had success in everything that he did because God was with him. And when Saul saw that he had success, he stood in fearful awe of him. Saul is afraid of him. He can't stop thinking about David. He's having nightmares about this shepherd boy, which is very odd if you think about it, because Saul himself was the king. He had authority to do whatever he wanted. In fact, he was taller than everybody by like a feet, but he's afraid of a little young shepherd teenager. And so Saul, one day he can't stand it anymore, and he thought of a plan to get rid of David in secret. His daughter, Michal, loved David. And so he thought, I'm going to give my daughter to David, but he has to kill 100 Philistines as a bride price. Saul thought that this is going to make him die for sure. And David took the challenge. In fact, he went and he killed 200 of them. And Saul had no choice than he had to give his daughter to David. And Saul, at this point, was even more afraid of David. And so Saul became David's enemy. One day he has had enough, and he ordered the death of David now in public, not in private. He gone so far to even killing a priest and all the priest's family and the entire city where the priest lives in, because he found out that the priest helped David. And we would read that Saul would spend the rest of his life under the bondage of envy and eventually consumed by envy. All that because of one line. I had thousands. He had 10,000s. Church, have you ever felt envious of somebody? Maybe it's a sibling. Maybe it's a sibling that your dad liked more. It's pretty obvious. He shows him favor all the time. Maybe it's your cousin. Your cousin that your mom kept comparing you to because that cousin is successful. He and or she does something really well. Or maybe it's not your family members. Maybe it's your brother or your sister at church because you guys are serving on the same team. Maybe it's your childhood friend. You have a childhood friend, your high school friend, your elementary school friend. In fact, you guys grew up together. You guys were born in the same year. She is younger than you by just a little bit. The whole time when you were in school with them, you've always thought, she is just skinnier than me by a little bit, taller than me by a little bit. Her hair is longer than me by a little bit. She's more popular than me just a little bit. She has a little more friends than I do. In fact, both of you guys were in the volleyball team. She was better than you just by that much. So she's starting and you're on the bench. Now you guys are out to work. You actually gave her a favor. You helped her to get a job at your company. But she climbs faster than you do. She makes a little bit more money than you do. One day you guys were chatting at the end of the work and you found out that her boyfriend is going to come to pick her up. You also had a boyfriend. Both of you have boyfriends. Her boyfriend, you found out, plays basketball. Her boyfriend is 5'11". Your boyfriend plays basketball on the PS5. He is 5'8" on a good day. Her boyfriend drives a Porsche. Your boyfriend drives Uber Eats. Even her boyfriend is a little better than yours. And she told you, I got engaged this summer. I'm getting married next summer. And your response is obviously, oh, I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy for you. Can we see photos? Can we see the ring? And you saw the ring. You wish you didn't see the ring. The ring is so shiny. That diamond is so big. And the color is so nice. And so you unconsciously covered yours that you got the last summer. And they said, we are thinking to have our wedding in Paris. You talked to your boyfriend that you're going to have your wedding in Kelowna. And so then you guys keep talking, you keep talking, and all of a sudden the conversation got to church. She knows that you've gone to church when you were young. And she says, I actually want to go back to church with my boyfriend. I haven't been for a long time now, but I'm going to go back. I want to go back. So she asks you a question. Do you go to church? How are you going to answer her? Or maybe the better question is, can you bear the thought of having a better version of yourself with you here? Can you bear the thought of having a better version of you, not just in your office now, but at your church? And now to your personal life, a better version of you. Have you ever felt envious of somebody? If you have, you will have some idea of how envy works. And I'm going to take some time to try my best to break it down. I'm no psychologist, but I'll try. How does envy work? What is envy? Envy is a pain that you feel when you desire what other people have that you don't. There's a quote by Oz Guinness. He wrote in a book, The Call. This is a Christian writer. He says, envy enters when seeing someone else's happiness or success, we feel ourselves called into the question. Then out of the hurt of our wounded self-esteem, we seek to bring the other person down to our level by word or deed. Envy is a pain that leads to destruction, to bringing other people down because they have something that you don't. Now, where does envy happen? There's usually three conditions that you have to meet. There is somebody that's close to you in proximity. There's somebody that's similar to you. And there's somebody that's better than you. Usually you have to meet all three of these on a person for you to feel envious. And the point is this. You are very rarely envious of Elon Musk. You may want his wealth, but you're not envious of him. You are very rarely envious of a celebrity because they're far away. Or maybe they have talents. Or you're very rarely envious of somebody of a different life stage. But you're always envious of somebody that looks a little like you, that works a little bit like you, that talks a little bit like you, but is a little bit better than you. And they're always in that circle of influence, that circle of friend group that you're in. Now, why is envy bad? Why is envy so deadly? What are the effects of envy? Because envy leads to all other kinds of sins. There's like a spiral. Saul went down a spiral. Saul found envy, and then we read that he found anger and displeasure, and he became afraid. He became little. And then he was obsessed, and he was malicious, as in he wanted to harm David. And then he was just consumed, and he would commit murder on other people, and he wanted to kill David. Envy leads to all kinds of other sins. To which you thought, I don't actually murder people. To which I thought, that's great. I'm glad that you're here. But if you think about it, you don't murder people, but you might have wanted to get rid of people in your mind. How I wish he or she would go overseas to study so I don't have to face them anymore. I wish my coworker gets promoted to Toronto. I hope my friend goes to another church. Perhaps you have even tried to manipulate certain things, to say certain things, or do certain things so that you can bring them down. Level the playing field a little bit, even if it's in your head. And the bad thing, the scary thing about envy is you don't even have to murder somebody to have envy consume you. Murder is like that final cherry on top. If envy gets you to be obsessed with a person, gets you to become afraid or threatened or feel small, it's already eaten you. Why is it so bad? Because envy destroys the community. It's the antithesis of love. Love is rejoicing when somebody does well. Envy is lamenting when people do well. And all of that means envy is like a chain. It's like a chain that have you shackled and enslaved. It's a chain that went through your hands and your arms, and it's painful. No one likes to be envious. You might like to be slothful. You might like to be angry. You might even like to be prideful. Nobody likes to be envious of somebody. Because you know why? Because it hurts. It says there's something in you that is less than the other person. And what happens is when envy grabs hold of you, you are crippled and you're consumed. You can't function. You're thinking, oh, no, how do I get better than the person? Why did God make that person? Why is he just a little bit better than me? Why is she a little bit better than me? And mentally, you're just overwhelmed. You can't carry out your normal day. Envy is a chain that chains you down. Now, if you ask psychologists, they will tell you that there are some solutions to envy, which I think they kind of work. The first solution that they will have is you should practice gratitude. Because why? Gratitude acknowledges what you have so that you can give thanks for what you have, and it trains your mind and your heart to look at the right things. But from my experience, I don't know about you, but from my experience, it doesn't always work. You know why? Because when you start to think about what you have, you start to think about what they don't have. And you start to keep comparing. He has a car, I don't have a car, I have a dog, he doesn't have a dog, I have a girlfriend, he doesn't have a girlfriend. And it doesn't work because the math never equals out. And in fact, if you just keep playing this comparison game, it hardly makes anybody happy. It just makes everybody sad. It works, but something's missing. The other thing psychologists would tell you, essentially, is fake it till you make it, till you feel it. You talk good about the person. You go up to, oh, you look really nice today. Oh, your nails are really nice. Oh, your hair, you did your... And the point is, hopefully, by repeating this to yourself, you would genuinely like that person. But that's hard. You don't even want to approach that person. The third thing, essentially, psychologists would agree is, you should limit all social media use, which I agree. Limit that passive sort of scrolling social media. Because psychology have agreed that pretty much nobody feels better after you scroll social media. And the things that you see on social media is Photoshopped, is edited, is the perfect moment when everything lines up perfectly and you thought, that's what they have? I'm struggling with what? So the bandage solution, if you don't want to feel envy, you don't want to deal with it, is, well, just shut off all the other stuff and don't interact with them. But I think you will agree with me that even though those are some good ideas, they are not core fixes. They don't fix the root problem of envy. So what's the root cause of envy. May I suggest to you, the cause of envy is a matter of two things: your value and your identity. Your value and your identity. It's a matter of your value because there's this false belief, there's this belief that sometimes we have, that you are only valuable when you have more than others. You are only valuable when you have more than the others. And so with that logic is, I cannot have somebody else have more than I do because that makes me invaluable. That makes me lose my value. Envy is a matter of identity because there is this belief that we need to be unique so we stand out, so we matter. That's who I am. You cannot bear to have a person similar to you in your social circle because if they are similar to how you identify yourself, you become a lesser version of them. Let me give you an example. When I first joined the music team, that was a long time ago now, when I was grade 10, I was known as the new young piano player. New young piano player. I felt great. That's my identity. That's who I was. Now, there's another piano player that joined exactly the same time. He was also a guy. He was also a high school grad. In fact, he was 1 year or 2 years younger than I was. He was also going to UBC School of Music in the same small group. Come on. I was the new young piano player. Now, all of a sudden, there is another new young piano player. But he's more talkative. He's more showy. He's more extroverted. He's more popular. I want to confess to you, I absolutely hated his guts. I'm better now. Because that made me a lesser version of him. That made me insignificant. That cannot happen. So maybe for you, it's not a new young piano player. Maybe for you, it's a servant that is caring, detail-oriented, and a program planner. Now, if there's another caring, detail-oriented program planner, and they have better hair than you do, oh no, you have become a lesser version of them. You are now a nobody. Maybe it's your workplace. You're a new employee that works hard and is talented. If there's a new employee that's hardworking, talented, and they drink, sociable, you have become a lesser version of them. And so it's understandable why you feel envious, because envy seeks to protect you. Envy wants to protect your value and your identity. It does not allow somebody to be better than you because they want you to feel valuable. Envy does not allow people to replace you. Envy guards your identity. Now, so hopefully you see why. If you want to address envy, it's not as simple as being grateful and, you know, gratitude. It's not as simple as, you know, talking well about somebody. You have to go deep into the root and ask the question about value and identity, which is what we're going to do. So the first thing we have to figure out is, where does your value come from? Where does your value come from, and what is your value? And to look at that, we're going to go into Psalm 139. Just a little short passage in there. Some of you are familiar with this. Psalm 139 is a poem written by David from the David and Saul story. David starts by saying, God knows him intimately. Oh Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. Then David goes on to say how God knows him before he was born. And this is the part I want you to remember. Psalm 139, verse 13. David says, for you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. David said it was God that made you when you were in your mom's tummy. And David described God like an artist weaving together a piece of art tapestry. And David continues, and then David says, I praise you then, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Fearfully is not a word that we use often. Fearfully is, the best I can get to, is kind of like awe-inspiring. It's kind of like amazing. It's the thing that you feel when you hike up to the mountain and you see the view of the lower mainland. You're like, wow. Some of you went to Alaska in the summer, you know, your cruise. You see those glaciers and you're like, wow. Some of you went to Niagara Falls last week. Wow. Niagara, wow. Fearfully made. you fearfully made. Wonderfully made. Wonderful is to be distinct, to be set apart, to be special. And David then, he says, wonderful are your works, my soul knows it very well. This second, wonderful, it means a little bit different. It means marvelous. It means surpassing and extraordinary. So you have three adjectives that David has given you to describe you. Describe me. That we are a piece of artwork woven together by master artist. We are fearfully made, wonderfully made, and we are marvelous. But the important thing is this does not describe you now. You are not jaw-dropping because you're young and you're beautiful and your skin is nice. No. You're not even special because you have a fit body and you have muscles. You're not even extraordinary because you're talented and you're skilled and you work well. These adjectives apply to you when you were in your mother's womb. The point is, David is saying, you are intrinsically valuable, beautiful, and precious. Because it's the God who made the stars and the galaxies, he made you. The master artist of this universe made you. That's where your value comes from. I want to give you an example to hopefully demonstrate this point a little bit. A few weeks ago, my wife was showing me a picture of a baby. We get a lot of baby ads right now. We get a lot of sort of baby things, baby pictures. And so she was looking at this photo, and she said, wow, it's so cute. Baby is so beautiful. The tiny little arms is so cute. That's exactly how she sounds like. She sounds much better than I do. And then to which I thought, well, that's your usual response to all babies. So I brushed it off. I said, well, all babies are the same. But she insisted that I look at the picture. And when I saw it, I didn't think much of it. But the more I looked at it, the more it grew on me. And I thought, wow, that is really the most beautiful baby on this planet Earth. No question. That's the baby. That is an ultrasound picture of my child when he was 8 weeks old. 8 weeks old. What do you mean he's cute? What do you mean he's beautiful, little arm? He looks like a blob. And that's exactly the point. He doesn't need to show me his arms or his face. He is intrinsically valuable, beautiful, and precious to me. When he comes out of his mother's womb in a month, he can look like anything. It will not change who he is to me. A few years later, it doesn't matter if he has a preschool friend. That's more handsome than he is. Maybe he has a little Mozart that's his friend and then has perfect pitch and knows everything. It does not change who he is to me. Same goes with you. You were made by God, fearfully and wonderfully made. Doesn't matter if you have a cousin that looks better than you. Doesn't matter if you have a friend that has a better job. It doesn't change you. You are intrinsically valuable, beautiful, and precious. That's the value question. The second thing we're going to address is the identity question. What's your identity? Are you the young, new piano player, the caring, detailed program planner that serves the church? Let's see what God says. Another passage we're going to look at, Ephesians chapter 1. Very familiar passage for some of you, but it's super important. Don't miss this. This is a book written, and a letter written by Apostle Paul. Apostle Paul, he starts by saying, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. Paul starts off by praising God for all the spiritual blessing that he's given us. And he elaborates, and this is important. You can't miss this. Paul says, even as God chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before him in love. There are at least three identities that you should hold on to here. You are chosen, you're holy, and you're beloved. Chosen before the foundation of the world, mind you. You know what that means? It means you were chosen before you were that little being in your mother's womb. You were chosen before your mother was a little being in her mother's womb. before all of your ancestors, to the point where before the earth was made, before the galaxies came to be and your science people, before space and time, when there was nothing, God says, I thought about Carson, and I'm going to choose him. I thought about Howard, and I'm going to choose him. I thought about Vivian, and I'm going to choose her. Chosen to be what? To be holy, to be perfect, blameless, like him. To be in love. In love. Not only that, Paul continues. He says, God predestined us, predecided, predetermined that you are going to be adopted to himself as sons through Jesus Christ, like a child to himself, a son of God, a daughter of God. That's your identity. That's where your identity comes from. You think you are a piano player first. You think you are a project planner first. You think you are a popular student that does sports well at school. When you think these things, when somebody comes along and they're better than you at that, you're threatened. Of course you're threatened. But God says, you're not a lesser version. You're not even a nobody. You are far more than that. You are a child of God that's holy and beloved and chosen. Now, I want to try to explain or maybe make my point even further. Being somebody's child doesn't feel that big of a deal now in Canada. As in, when my child comes out, he's not going to say, I am, whatever his name, son of Carson. Carson's son. That's not what he's going to say. But I want to tell you, this is much more significant than you're aware of. Let me give you an example. I'll try my best. This is a fictional example. Anybody watch Thor? You know how Thor introduces himself? I am Thor, son of Odin. Why would you introduce yourself as son of Odin when you are the Earth God of Thunder yourself? Because Odin is the boss. Odin is the god of wisdom, the bringer of peace, king of Asgard. So being a son of Odin means nobody mess with you in Asgard. Being a son of Odin means you have authority and you have status in Asgard. People bow to you. Being a son of Odin means he belongs to somebody. Being a son of Odin means he is a dot in this big, big universe, and he linked himself to a history, to a lineage, to a line, so that you're not a floating random dot just kind of floating in the universe. It gave him meaning. That's Odin. That's a myth. But your God is not a myth. You are the son and daughter of God Most High, Yahweh. I am the creator of this universe, the King of Kings. You're linked to him. I am Carson, son of God. You are son of God, daughter of God. So next time when envy creeps in, and envy says, I need to do that protecting thing. Envy wants to protect you of your value and your identity. You can just say, envy, I don't need your help. I don't need protection. You know who my father is? When somebody better than you comes along, they don't make you less valuable. You are already precious. You're already beautiful and valuable when you're a little blob in your mother's womb. And no one can threaten your position because you're chosen, you're holy, and you're a beloved child of God. What you need to do then, I suggest, coming out of here, you have to embrace and accept this identity that God has given you. Internalize it. Pastor Fizz, my wife, she helped me out a lot here. She said what has helped her is going to help me, and I think it will help you. And it's very simple. When you feel envy, when you feel like there's a better version of you that came along, when you feel like you're a little, you're nobody, you're afraid, you tell yourself, pray it aloud. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. I am chosen, holy, and beloved child of God. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. I am chosen, I am holy, and I am the beloved child of God. Let every moment and feeling of envy that you have be a cue for you. Remember your value, remember your identity. And then you can go practice the gratitude. You can go practice speaking well of somebody. You can go now start to see how God has made you uniquely. But you must remember, you start from there. You're fearfully and wonderfully made. And you're chosen, holy, beloved, child of God.